This is a statement about the fundamental nature of letters and their sounds. It says a vowel can be pronounced in two or three different ways. So the letter A can be pronounced short as in fat, long as in late, and so on. Well, it's very important to realize here that we must distinguish between the sound and the symbol we use to represent it. For instance, here it says the letter A. Now, it says that this A can be pronounced as short, A, and long, A. It can be pronounced also, for a very long time if you wanted to. But the important thing to remember is that the vowel represented by this letter in English represents a variety of obscure sounds. And when we're talking about the significance, we are talking about the significance of sound. Not the symbol itself, but the sound that it represents. And therefore, it is in the sound, not in the sign, that we find the significance. This R, we once drew before, also upside down. And we said that the one upside down used to be a drawing of an ox, like this. And the one this way up was a drawing of an eagle. And it represented two kinds of energy. An energy vectored upwards and an energy vectored downwards. This down vectored R is the privative R for the alpha deprived of ascending energy. It is passive, it is accepting. This one is active, ascending. This one we call the spiritus asper, the hard, and this one the spiritus lenis, the soft one. So we mustn't be confused by the symbols. We must always go to the sound and learn to think in terms of the sound. So English is full of obscure vowels and is therefore simultaneously the best language and the worst to think about sound significance in. If we take the vowels in continental languages, apart from mispronunciations of them, and set them in this order, E, A, R, O, and then pronounce them as English people would pronounce them in the alphabet, that would be pronounced A-E, which is already a diphthong, A-E, A. That would be pronounced R-E, I-E, which is a diphthong. That one would be pure E, except in a word, but it could be E. O is another diphthong, O-U. And this one is E-U, U. So with the exception of the E in English, all these things are really diphthongs. So if we want to get to the sound significance and not be confused by the symbol that we use to represent it, we must learn to think in a continental manner. If those were Italian vowels, they would be pronounced E, A, R, or U. And those are all pure sounds, they're not diphthongs. So if we wrote this combination, which in English you would say A and I, a continental would pronounce it I. And if we wrote this, that would be O. So we have to consider the exact meaning of each of these sounds and use a language that is consistent as a basis of our symbology. Now the Latin vowels, the Italian vowels, are the closest to the pure forms. This is E, A, R, O, U. Now, if we consider what it is saying in this question, it is wanting to know why the same vowel can mean different things. And it says here, as they can be pronounced differently, and yet there is something similar, something the same in them. What is the sameness? Well, it's obvious that they cannot be pronounced differently at all. Every vowel is itself. If we write this down and don't anglicize it, it is R. And it is pronounced with the roof of the mouth and the tongue flat. Now you can see the origin of the form of the letter there. That is R. If the tongue simply rests in the mouth, flat, then it pronounces R. If you lift the tongue up like this, you will start saying A, pure A, not A, English, A. And you get immediately a sensation of weakening, this R and A. If you push the tongue in such a way that you leave only a tiny little hole in here for the air to come through, it says E. So that in actual fact, the vowel E is the smallest vowel we've got. It's the one that uses the least space, which is why Christ says of it, the yod, this is the vowel E, written I, don't think in English. This is the yotta of the Greek and the yod of the Hebrew. It is the smallest letter, we represent it with a dot on it, and put an indicator underneath the dot to show where the dot is. The Greeks represented without the dot because they were very rational, and they said, well, the dot could be a bit of dirt on the paper and cause confusion, so we'll just draw a simple vertical for it. The important thing to remember is that it is actually a dot, a yot, jot. And the significance of the vowel R means just what a hemisphere means, and obviously in a sphere there are two of them. So there is one up and one down. So we have two ways of saying R. On a rising cadence, R, which means look out, I have energy, and falling, R, which means loss. You can feel the difference very, very easily. And to say R with a rising cadence means I detect you, I am alert, awake. And if you say R, that means loss. You can feel it. The significance is in the feeling. Remember, feeling is field consciousness, and when you arrange your vocal apparatus in a certain way, the tensions in it give you a certain feeling, and the feeling varies according to the way you hold your vocal apparatus and in so doing produce vowel sounds. So the E in keen really means already what keen means. It's a thin, tiny, precise sound. You notice that Bertrand Russell and other mathematical thinkers always move towards E. Everything they say is very forward in math and tends to become thin. It's the E in thin. So the R means an energy either going up or down, increasing or decreasing. And O, you cannot pronounce O without rounding your mouth. And therefore, it means to comprehend, to enclose. Ooh, you pronounce with the lips protruded, and it's a very good sound to watch in the case of monkeys. When monkeys are very pleased or excited and want to get at something, they always stick the lips well out and say, ooh, ooh. And this is the reason why we use the word ooh in woo. Woo means just that tending to urge towards something. So we now have a series of operations of power, really. This is the oo in push. The oo in the French for thumb, push. The oo. And you know when you're using effort, you tend to say oo. So it means power, effort. This comprehension one means a priori intellection. This e means particular, empirical experience. A means feeling, and R means desire energy, either gaining its object or losing its object. So we now have a series of symbols. We mustn't be deceived by the English diphthongs. We must learn to ignore them and get used to thinking in terms of these Italian vowels and realize just precisely what they mean. So every time in a word we see U, we know that that word signifies, insofar as that element is in it, an urge, a push, a power. When we see O,
It symbolizes comprehension. We must remember that there's nothing in the O, so it can symbolize zero comprehension. Nevertheless, it's comprehension. You notice all organizations that finish in O, like you know and so on, tend to do nothing except run round and round and round the subject. And they very seldom go in to it. This R, we've said, means energy, either gaining or losing. And this vowel, A, is the peculiar vowel of feeling. Now, a very good way of studying this empirically, if you've got a child, is to tickle it and slap it and annoy it and stuff it with chocolates and so on. And listen to the different sounds of the vowels. You'll find that when a child is angry, he cries on the vowel R. And when the child is mawkish, self-pitying, he cries A. You won't find a newborn baby saying E, because that would require it to lift the tongue up into a position and hold it in that position, implying precision. That will develop later. You'll notice it's very frequently sung thick, that vowel. Instead of a clean E in a song, you'll hear people, through trying to get round quality, which belongs to this vowel, saying E. So the attempt to give a warmth in singing to the vowel E. Every word means exactly what it says, and not something else. So that, given this phonetic structure and sensitive feeling, you can correct a dictionary. You can say, well, it isn't dubious because it's such a word, and you can turn the dictionary to that other word and show that the derivation is entered there. Also, you can show very frequently that the compiler of the dictionary is telling lies when he says that the etymology is unknown or dubious. So, here is our principal structure. Now, the oldest name for God that we have extant is simply that row of vowels. And God is free spirit, and the vowels are also free. That is, they're not chopped. They're not cut with a K or a T or a D. They are free. The word Jehovah is really, in its original form, a row of vowels, like this. And if we like to add on to it these two, the U and the U, we have seven vowels. One should be at one end and one at the other. Let's do it. There's U, which is the urge plus precision. And at the other end here is the U, which is the comprehension plus feeling. Or to be more phonetically accurate, urge becomes refined to its own experiences. It goes in self-pity. As it's going through the painful experiences, it becomes very sorry for itself and progressively enlightened. So we now put inside here E and A and R in between. Here is a precision, here is an energy, and here is a feeling. This H is the glyph of our feeling. Incidentally, the fifth letter in our English is A, but it used to be written with the sound for H. But the same thing, namely feeling, when intensified, becomes a hard aspirate, the eighth letter, the aspirate A. And people that leave it off are generally deficient in the desire to rule. And people that put it on too much have too much desire to rule. So, if we take all the vowels, we have U and O, and the terms, we now have the glyph, which represents the free spirit in fivefold aspect in manifestation, and in this peculiar duality outside manifestation, where the potentiality of power and the potentiality of feeling, precision and the potentiality of feeling here, plus intellection. This is the vowel E over there, crossing into this O. This is the vowel U, crossing into A. Urge becomes feeling. In other words, if you run very, very hard at a wall, you will feel something. You will run U at the wall, and then you will feel A. And these vowels are very expressive. You can hear the self-pity in the vowel A. Just pronounce this flat A in a falling cadence, and you immediately feel sorry for yourself. And this being sorry for oneself is called self-pity, because one feels that one is in the pit. And if one had not been urgeful in the first place, one would never have got the painful experiences that would lead to the enlightenment of refined feeling. It is said that feeling is the basis of culture and good taste. And the other people that hadn't got that refined feeling were simply people who had not yet received a sufficiently hard bashing. So that when they talked about the barbarians in the old days, the unshaven, they were talking about people who were just going about pleasing themselves and not really hurting themselves very much. But as those who really did push hard and were hurt and felt the pity of it, decided to give it up. Well, we've said before that the belly department is urgeful. We can write U in there. We can write R in there and E there. That's again Jehovah, Yahu. And this is the great question. Why aspirated? Why? The question. Reply, you. Yahu. You exist. You have, therefore, to face evolutionary processes. And in the process of evolution, you will pass from primary urge through energetic application into precision. And the precision arises, as we've said before, through the negation of the urge. You can't learn to think accurately unless somebody keeps you on the shin occasionally. So I think that should, for the time being, clarify that particular question. Now we've got a handful of questions here. This one about the development of talents. I was once told that a person who can do anything well can do anything else well. Well, this is really a statement about the nature of intelligence itself. If we remember that the tel in intelligence, there's a Greek word, telos, purpose. See, if we put intel, lig, hence, this lig means join, it's exactly the same word as yoga. In fact, if we write the thing in Greek like this, and change the vowel e to o, we have the log, the basis of the logos. This is the lig in religion. This is ens, essence. The essence, tying, purpose in. So intelligence means that essential substance which is able to put inside itself purpose. This tel is also the base of the word tol, tolerant. Tol means Lord, he who has attained order in himself. So the question of whether a person with one talent can have many is fairly obvious. If he is really intelligent, then whatever he applies himself to, apart from actual physical disabilities, like being born 2 feet high and wanting to run faster than anybody else, which would circumscribe you a bit, the intelligent being can be good at every subject that he attacks. And it's tremendously important to realize that. Nevertheless, where we start from, we are already loaded down with hereditaments. Some of us are 2 feet and some of us are 7 feet. I've got a friend who's 6'7", whose feet are outside the bed all night in the cold. And he doesn't mind in the summer, but he doesn't mind in the winter. And he's so tall that his wife can't sleep with him in the bed, because it makes her uncomfortable to have a draught coming from below. where his feet stick out. So they have to have separate beds. So although he may have a talent, say, for certain activities, nonetheless his natural physical irritants tend to interfere with them. So, as far as the intelligence is concerned, we can say that intelligence actually does develop all the talents in the universe. Intelligence is fundamentally an essence which is identical with the fundamental field consciousness, which, feeling its own potentiality, mobilizes itself and becomes will. Feeling mobilized is will, then applies itself in a situation with alertness, and again its feeling, pleasure, pain, formal relation, develops intellect out of it. Intellect has simply this lek function with a unit. That's intellig, and this is intellect. And this lek is the same thing as the lek in lecture. It's to do with writing and reading. And the intellect is concerned with writing down and fixing. That's the meaning of the T there. It's going to make a precise written symbol for everything it knows. So the intellect is concerned with the establishment of a symbology that will enable it to control all the other aspects of its being. So the difference between intelligence and intellect is simply that the intellect writes down, graphs, the results of its intelligent research. The rest of this is other particular. Now, I've missed a particular bit that isn't really necessary to deal with. Is there a level where you can tune in to have any ability you want? Well, of course, we've already said that, that there is such a level, the level of intelligence. You remember we said that the O symbolizes the a priori intellect. It is the limit of definition. To go beyond it is to go outside definition. Beyond definition is the field undefined. Plotinus is concerned in talking about this. This is the macrocosmic limit, the limit of reason. Nevertheless, he wasn't such a fool as to say beyond reason is no value. Beyond the tautological definitions of reason is the original field which created the sphere of reason. Ratio is internal to the sphere. Outside the sphere is the source of the sphere, the source of rationality, which transcends rationality. When Christ is talking about gaining the kingdom of heaven first, and then all these things will be added, then he's talking about the limit, the firmament here. This is the firmament. And the firmament is the zone of activity which came into being through the field pressing on the centre. There's the vowel E, there's R, there's O. This is the firmament of Genesis, and it is said in Genesis to be called heaven, and the firmament he called heaven. Heaven means the heaved up. So, if we imagine a force pushing out to meet the force pushing in, to every action there's an equal and opposite reaction, where those two forces balance is the firmament called heaven. So heaven also means power, even, equilibrated power. It's also the haven, the resting place, because equilibration of power is rest and is security. So if we gain this equilibration band, we're actually on the door between the undefined feeling consciousness and intellection. So if we stand here, we can feel what the feeling is trying to do next before it actually does it. Christ standing here, the word Christ means circle with a cross in it. Christ standing on the edge here, and feeling what is going on outside, calls this outside the Father, and says, my Father works, and I work. My Father works in secret, I work openly. and he meant closedly. That is to say that when he worked in Sam's circle so that beings in the circle could see him, he was making manifest a new stage of evolution initiated by the Father and formulated by the Son. So we can see here that the level at which all abilities become possible is the level where your intellect has reached its term and the next step is pure feeling. So when you climb beyond the mind and its five sense data into the a priori zone of pure intellection, and then take the top intellectual concept, which is a sphere, and know that whatever you look at, wherever it is, it, by its existence, is demonstrated to be circumscribed and is therefore subject to the law of enclosure, and as such, being finite, cannot refer to that which is beyond. So you place yourself right on the edge of it, so that all intellection is below you, and above you is the unformulated but formulating feeling. You then find in yourself a tendency, a feeling tendency. Tendency means holding essence, doesn't it? That feeling is essentially a tendency to hold, which every spirit seeks a body. This spirit here seeks this body and sacks the body, to seek and put in the sack. This is related to the sacrum. Put the other eye, you can see. There's your spine and there's your sacrum, your sacred sacral plexus, where the creative energy is stored up. Here we can actually feel what we will be doing in a few years' time. That is to say, we can feel the totality of our destiny. Destiny is the destination impulse, where we are trying to get. Long before a person can define it accurately at the waking level of consciousness, he has already decided in feeling where he wants to get. So the more you can climb to the limit of intellection and then look at the feeling tendency, the more you can see what is going to happen inside here. All the prophets are concerned to get to this point where they can see what the Father Spirit is willing as the next evolutionary development. John the Divine, the beloved of Christ, is the intellect climbed up to the point of perceiving spirit, but in a particular being. His intellect divining the next evolute. Evolute is outwilling. Funnily enough, the outwilling is inwilling, because it is the transcendent Father Spirit that appears in a sphere here and then pushes out from that sphere certain talents. But first they must be put in before they can come out. They're put in eternally, in eternality, to come out in time. So there is no evolution without previous involution. So that's the power that we have to seek. There's a question here that's related to our maze concept, the relation of fantasy. Fantasy is not necessarily rubbish. If you sort fantasy out, it is truth. When we look at the word fan and we spread out the hand like a fan and then close it up and make fist, which is Faust, then you see that if we wrap up all the maze energy of the Father Spirit into a ball, that's like closing your fist. This is the Faust. Goethe and others are writing about Faust is German for fist. The wrapped up energy, the pushing energy, the ball of energy. And he's selling himself to Mephistopheles for power. Mephistopheles is the substantial ripples, fired and fixed. So it means the analytical power that man must use in order to turn from a Faust, a primary urge being, into a being of precise abilities and talents. Everything that is disordered out here and is called fantastic, when it is let into this circle and rotated and put into order and categorized, is then no longer fantasy. Fantasy just means a display. And if the display is not orderly, then the person that's perceiving it is confused. Some fans have scenes painted on them. And when the fan is closed, you can't tell what's in it, except dabs of colour on the edge. And when you open the fan, suddenly you see it's a Japanese landscape, priced fourpence. And then what was fantastic, hidden and secret becomes a very plain diagram. The whole process is simply a move from this oo through all the intermediary stages to the precise E within the circle, and then out here it is saying the obscurities are out there. But analyze that by the intellect, they are truth. Truth is formal reality. And I think as we go on to this subject, we should now be very, very clear about the function of feeling. We said that man is a three-part being. This is the urge department. We wrote in here the art, the aspiration, and their precision for the intellect. But we said that when this urge runs into a situation, such that the situation defeats the urge, the oo changes into a. So in the feeling department, the aspiration, the ambition, the determination to show the other fellow who's best, gradually alters from R to A. And then it becomes progressively more and more sensitive. Now, the fact that these three exist in relation shows a unifying principle. So we draw a big circle to include them all. And we allow all the field to be represented by the vowel A. This is the flat vowel, the plane, A, plane. That's good plane. So here is a sphere now, full of feeling, now made sensitive, because once it was an urgeful push, which got hurt by applying itself in a particular situation, and the particular pressing on the urge caused it to flatten. Now there is a diagram of the Earth also. Here is the South Pole, here's the North Pole, and here's the equatorial plane. This equatorial plane is the vowel A. And all our feeling is concerned with discovering the relation between a particular form and an urge which arises in us. Now, about the time of Aristotle, they didn't divide man into three parts, they divided him into two parts. The intellective part and the volitional, or appetite, part. They would call that appetency, the orectic. And this would have been the nous, the tire up, the tire upper. So intellection and urge were the two modes that the early philosophers saw in the human being. It isn't until, I think, about the 18th century when a German decides that feeling exists. That's quite a long time. This Aristotelian definition was current right into the Middle Ages, and then a doubt began to arise about it, and we can see why that doubt arose in the evolutionary sense. In the old days, we could say there were two kinds of people. People that didn't want to think, and they ran away every time there was a limiting factor, and those who did want to think. Those more city people. these are the nomadic peoples. Gradually, the relation between these two produces a feeling of tentativeness, of unguardedness. If some people like to settle down in a walled city and to define inside the walled city, that's this E function, what kind of society they will have, they have to be very careful, because outside here a lot of barbarians keep rushing in and knocking the walls down. So you can see that the formal social definers inside here had to have guards on their firmament, with their eye always on the barbarians, so that they could be ready. So around here they developed a very sensitive apprehension of possible dangers, so that the feeling relation again grew up between a formal definition, social structure, and some barbarians outside. The same thing happens exactly in the human body, where the head, the intellectual center, formulates what ought to be done. The belly urge keeps rushing and smashing the place to pieces, and as a result, between the two, gradually feeling grows. The energy pushes up from below, the negation energy pushes down, and the result is it spreads out in the middle. So the plane of feeling is a product of these two. Now, because of this, some philosophers decided, not so very long ago, that probably feeling was primal, that it was older than intellection and urge. And they were immediately refuted by other thinkers who said feeling discriminates between pleasant and painful, and pleasant and painful, being discriminated, have had the intellect applied to them. Because if you define the intellect as a discriminator, and then you say that feeling is discriminating between pleasure and pain, you said that feeling is intellection. Now, we've said before that unless we take the concrete whole, in this case the whole sphere, and consider all its relations simultaneously, we are indulging in abstract thinking. So the man who said feeling is primal, and the man who refuted it by saying there is intellect in it because it discriminates, were arguing about the nature of abstract and concrete realities. Prior to every turn is the infinite field. The turn itself is a product of potentialities of the field. So the first sphere which appears, the macrocosmic sphere, is already a product of an infinite field. And the infinite field, therefore, must have asserted of it that quality which can produce that sphere. That sphere is the a priori intellect, the geometrical before experience mode, and outside it is the non-intellectual field which made it. But in fact, we can't assert of the field that there was a time, because time is a product of rotation. We cannot assert that there was a time when the field was static, because the concept of static comes from the relation between finite forces opposing each other. So we must assume the field to have dynamic actuality. And if it has dynamic actuality, there is motion in it. But this motion is not relative as it is within the sphere, but absolute. And as the field is sentient itself, essentially feeling, then all motions in it must be purposeful. That is, it must be that feeling feels like moving in definite directions. But to move is urge. So we assert that in the field, insofar as there is motion, there is urge. And insofar as the motion is directional, we assert that it is intellectual. So in the infinite field, we have these three aspects in their concrete interrelations, that feel itself sentiency, pure feeling, because it is dynamic, is moving. As to its movingness, we call it urge. As to the direction of its movement, we call it intellection. So the infinite field is already threefold. And therefore, we shouldn't be surprised to find that a thing that is produced by the field has these three aspects. And then we can go to look inside our own organism and realize that we can know ourselves in three ways. The original way is the concrete feeling, motion, with the aspect of the motion constituting urge, and the aspect of the direction of the motion constituting intellection. This is a concrete fact in us, and therefore we know that if we think without feeling, we are deceived. Thinking is always accompanied by field states. Urge is always accompanied by field states. Urge is always directional, and direction belongs to the intellect, direct. The intellect is an operational faculty, and therefore there is motion in the intellect, and the motion belongs to the urge. And the intellect cannot operate and make conjunctions unless there is a conjunction principle, namely feeling. We feel from one idea to another. The idea is intellectual. We cannot make a connection between two ideas unless we feel like it. And if we don't feel like it, we won't be able to make it even if it's there. So here we have the concrete finite threefold and the concrete infinite threefold. And the only difference is whether we define an edge or not. For practical purposes, I define my edge, if I identify with this physical body, as bearing a certain relation to the chair. So that if I stand up and come to sit down in the same position, and one of you removes the chair, then I shall be on guard so that I don't sit on the floor by mistake. And in the process of this analysis, I shall be remembering previous falls from chairs being removed. And in the formal situation, I will be being intellectual. But remembering the unpleasantness of it, I will be feeling. And determining by my will, which is my urge, not to allow repetition, I will be doing a threefold concrete act. So, in this diagram, we have a mode of analysing our own state. And unless we put it into practice, it's not going to do us any good. To put it into practice, we have to learn to feel the pleasure-pain content of an idea to us. And we have to learn, when we feel a pleasure or a pain, to analyse it intellectually, to discover the exact form that is causing the feeling of pleasure or pain. And we have to become aware of our urge tendency to respond to the pleasure pain in the feeling zone and in the formally, intellectually defined aspect of it. So this requires that your consciousness shall continuously shift its frame of reference from intellect, feeling, volition. Or intellection, affection, as some psychologists call it, and cognition. Volition, affection, intellection. So, here we have to deliberately shift about in our body if we want to get the benefit. We can never do anything whatever unless we feel like cleaning. It is the feeling that mobilizes the will. But we won't feel like doing it unless we see a formal reason why we should succeed if we do it. So, the field consciousness, when it is dominant, gives us an awareness of the pleasure-pain value of idea and urge, and thus allows us to feed the urge, which is simply the field mobilized, and the intellect, which is field activity, compressed or precipitated. So always the centre of our attention should be feeling. It's out of this very fine feeling, the aesthetic sense, that comes all the culture that nations have produced. Simply feeling very carefully where your urge is trying to get, which is the same as feeling the direction of feeling, and feeling the particular formal stimulus that has acted upon you in order to provoke you to think that you will get some feeling satisfaction by allowing an urge to operate. So if we remember that, the best time for practicing this firmament balancing between intellection and the infinite feeling is, of course, when you're in bed, just before you're going to sleep, and just when you wake up. We can say the waking state is inside there, and the deep sleep is inside there, and the dreaming state is on the firmament. Because on that firmament you can feel values yet to be and formal situations already in existence, and balance the two. So when you go nearly to sleep and not quite, and keep turning back into the waking consciousness to get a form to serve as a reference point, and then feel back again to see what your as yet undefined feeling is moving towards, then you are really beginning consciously to create the direction of your life. Now, we've said before that if a person is in a nightmare, which is very, very unpleasant, they usually struggle and try to wake up. And the struggling disturbs the body, and that disturbs the forces in the body, redistributes the fluids and so on, with the result that the person becomes body conscious again. And then he has wakened up out of the dream, and we said that if we had no physical body to wake up to, we would then be stuck in the nightmare. This is why it is said that not even the gods can become free unless they gain human birth. You know that when man was created, according to the Muslim and Jewish tradition, he was created after the creation was finished. The angels had been made and creation had been finished, then man was made, and then God asked all the angels to come and salute man, and all the angels except one came and saluted him, and this one was called Iblis. And because he wouldn't salute man, God cursed him and he became Satan. Well, we can see mechanically why this is so. The father energy out here made man after he had made creation and the angels. The angels are the angle consciousnesses. Each angle of the absolute sphere is an angel, according to whether the angle is an acute one or not, or an obtuse one. So the angel is acute or obtuse. They are intelligences, because there isn't any substance other than intelligence. Sentience is fundamental substance. Therefore the angels are angels. So when the man was made, all the angel angles, if we pretend this is now the Big Mac sphere and man is inside here, each angel, you can see, is just himself. Every angel is an idea, a thought, an intelligence. But no angel is all of them. Each angle is peculiarly itself, and man summed all the angles, so that where man was, it was apparent that round him there was a possibility of an intelligence that could see that the angels, in being formalized permanently, could not grow like man could do. And he could see man's possibility of infinite evolution because of his threefold nature. And because he was in contact with man, therefore he became jealous.
turn and refuse to salute him. He said, I would like to be one of those. Therefore he was demoted. And he then became the gross material world, and his energies are directed to stopping man attaining his fullness. And this, of course, is permitted by the Father and seen inherently, so that man can find out precisely what he will do in the face of temptation. But he must have this adversary, otherwise he can't find out his own capacities. We can only know ourselves in opposition. When a child is trying to grow up, if you've got a child of intelligent parents, and let that child go away to be brought up by a congenital deficient, then the intelligence of the parents would not manifest, simply because the congenital deficient could not knock upon the child and provoke his internal form to come out. This is why human beings are said to be social animals. They cannot grow unless they can find somebody at their own level to knock upon and see a reaction. You may notice it, say, about puberty. Little boy coming towards it, not yet in it, looks at the other boys. He is in a state where you're not supposed to play with girls. These bigger boys, for some unknown reason, are breaking this taboo. You're supposed to be silly if you play with girls at a certain age, and slightly older, suddenly, it not only isn't silly, it's dumb. Now, he can't see his own potentiality in himself unless he sees an external manifestation of it, which stimulates him to look inside himself to see if he has inside himself some of that same substance which is operating in them. And therefore, in the relation between human beings, it is always necessary for an evolving being to find something at approximately his own level to tap upon, to get a reaction, and to give the stimulus to receive a reaction. And in the reciprocal relationship between them, they force each other up in the evolutionary scale. We could represent them like that if we wanted. Each one presses on the other until they get more and more vertical. It's in the reciprocal relation that human beings can grow. The early Christian saints proved that you can't grow in the desert on your own because they lack the stimulus that is needful. So now we come to this concrete fact and said that unless we had a gross physical body to refer to, if we were trapped in a mental state like a nightmare, we couldn't wake up. Now let's turn to the period when a man actually dies. We've referred to this before, and a man on the point of death frequently thinks over his life. Having died a few times myself, I know that this is true. He's down there waiting to die with his nose up and thinking. And what he's thinking about is, could he have done any different? And in the process, as the energies are leaving the body, there are two directions they can go. We'd use the ordinary Indian symbology for it and say, he can die in the blood system and he can die in the nervous system. If he dies in this system, he will go out of the mouth, and if he dies in this system, he will go out of the head. These are two symbolical ways of saying. You can die in appetite, this forward part of the body, and go back to try to get rebirth quickly with your interest on the material world. Or you can die in the control function, looking for the ultimate form that will enable you to escape. The question is often asked, is it possible to evolve after the death of the physical body? And the answer is yes, providing you want to. And that depends on how seriously you have viewed the direction of your life. Those people who don't believe in spirit, who don't believe in intelligence, and who believe that bodies are simply the result of a fortuitous concourse of atoms, think that death is death and they don't bother. And consequently, their minds are always turning backwards into the appetite, fulfillment and thwarting that they experience in their earth life, because they have no other. Consequently, all the formulations of them are fantastic, disordered and related to sense experience in the world, so that they would try to involve themselves into matter again. If we cut the legs off like that, we'll see that the cycle of that is so. As they're coming out, they're trying to enter into seed again. So that whenever there is a sexual relation and the possibility of an impregnation, these appetite beings are trying to gain an egg, to develop, to make another body. Material experience, who can't get in. So that their mode of life there is highly fantastic and continuously thwarted. It is said that human birth is very, very hard to get. And even numerically you can see that if you have an infinity of sentient beings and affinity of bodies, somebody is going to be disappointed. And the other path is to go by raising certain spinal energies through the top of the head and to the sun path. I won't draw it up here, I'll just leave it straight out. When you go to the sun path, you're going to the free. Surya is the Indian for the sun, the Hindu word. And it means free affirmation. Surya, to affirm freedom. When you go into the world, you're affirming bondage. If you affirm freedom, you're pulling yourself back, away from the sensual parts of the body, into the spinal centers and the brain, in order to control, in order to release yourself from external stimulation and slavery to mechanical body processes. So those beings who affirm freedom at the moment of death go into another state. These symbols only represent states, frequencies. You raise your frequency and you break the dominion of this cycle and move towards freedom. Now, we've said before there are two deaths, the death of your gross physical body and the death of an idea body that you have. If you have a gross physical body in there and it breaks up, falls to bits, and you have another body made of ideas derived from your five senses and they are not properly integrated, that too, after the stimulus value of the material world has been taken away, begins to disintegrate. You feel your ideas falling apart and you feel faint and you don't know what to do to gather them together. That's the same thing as going on the Pitriyam. On the other hand, if you have learned your fundamental geometry and you know that all finite being is finite being and must necessarily enslave you, if you like to, then you are going towards freedom, and by the inherent nature from the definitions, it cannot fall to bits. And this one sustains itself, so that one cannot die. That is your soul body with its inherences, as this one is your mental body derived from your five senses. So if you shift the accent of attention into the inherences of the soul, what you'll be concerned with are the primary dynamics of action and reaction, of pleasure pain, of taxic and tropistic theory, and it doesn't matter how scientific it seems to other people, you will know that it's for your good to know that when a stimulus hits a being, the being vibrates. That if the being falls into identification with the source of the stimulus, and the stimulus is pleasant, it will move towards it and be enslaved by it. This is why it says as part of the preliminaries to yoga practice, you must not receive gifts. Because if you do, you will be tied, if you're the kind of man that can be tied by a gift. Obviously, the only way you can receive a gift without being tied by it is by transcending absolutely the definition giver and receiver. which is possible to do. Otherwise, you would feel it necessary to recompense all the time and work upon the giver. On the other hand, if a stimulus comes and it's very painful, there might have been a bag of gold on the end of it, but you wouldn't know because you'd immediately run away. And these are fundamentals that have to be remembered. And you have to watch very, very carefully inside yourself to see those things towards which you tend to move and those from which you tend to move away. And you must examine the form of it and see precisely which little bit is moving you that way. Because only where you become really precise will you become really free. If you're generally precise, you'll be generally free. If you're particularly precise, you'll be particularly free. So, in taxic theory, in the motion reactions of a piece of protoplasm, is a very important key. An ordinary five-sense human being is no different from an animal. It's true that he's got a more complicated nervous system, but he's just as much dominated by the stimulus situation as an animal. And therefore, he was rated as an animal by those other beings who base themselves on this a priori geometry. These men were called the sons of God, those were called the sons of men. And those beings were considered to be simply rather clever animals. The apron that Adam wears after the fall, when Adam has been created like that, and through stimulus from below converts into this, and then he puts an apron on to cover up his nakedness, is a reference to his ape-like behaviour. He has decided to become like God and walk about with a very peculiar concept of what God is, and therefore he apes God. And to symbolise it, he puts on an apron. The symbol of work. He's going to keep himself clean while he's working, like a good boy. So in all this situation of the feeling in the field, its intellective and connective aspect, we have to remember that the three of them are concretely in a fourth undefined. That aspects of it, it operates in that way. And what we have to do is get hold of this fourth. And in doing so, we are sowing the seed, the same seed that Christ talks about, of release. Everything on earth that we see that is charming and tends to stimulate the reproductive sense will bind us. Everything we see that is painful to us is a little stimulus to help us to get free. So we should embrace the painful things because they refine the consciousness. And again, you have to remember that when you're embracing painful things, you have the rule you mustn't destroy the organ of your experience. So you must only take on those painful things that you can assimilate without decreasing your capacity for further experience. Now, have we got any particular questions that might be raised at this point?
Particularly one. Greek deities like Kronos and Pan.
Yeah.
Could they fairly be described as the Greeks, speaking of angels?
No, they're on the bigger concepts than angels. Kronos, of course, is Saturn, time. He is this big sphere turning. He's not simply one of the angles in it. He's a god, not an angel. The angels are subdivisions of these god spheres. Pan means all, nature, doesn't it? And when you consider nature as an undulating force, just going about aimlessly like a romantic, that is the meaning of Pan. When you consider the god Jupiter, or Zeus, as Jupiter, you're considering the man who generated, the intelligence who generated, the first Pi Torah, or Point Rota. He is God's father. As Zeus, he is the glistening ether, precipitating it. A slight sound shift in these words, the Sanskrit Dyaus, the Greek Zeus, the change out to Jupiter and so on, are simply changes of the aspects under which particular people view the same fact. If we say that the infinite is really an infinite ocean of light, then we can call it Zeus. If we say that that same infinite actually generated a big wheel, a big sphere of law, then his name is Jupiter. If we say that he is the supreme giver, we can see that he is Dao. Dao means to give. Giving implies cutting a bit off the infinite in order to give you the finite. So you change the name as you change the function. And it depends on the temperament of particular nations how they shall name the same reality. Because always this question of consciousness is a relation between a subject and an object. There is a subject and there is an object. Let's make three subjects. Shem, Ham and Yafet. And here is an object. Now that object, there's its equator. Nice and hot. There's a bit not quite so hot, and there's a bit fairly cool. They all look at the same concrete fact. And this fellow, whose name means hot and black, says, I think I'll go there. And this fellow, who's Shem, the voice that's going to try to integrate the lot, says, I'll wait to see where he goes, and then I'll go in between. And this one says, well, I don't want to waste my time, I don't want to get frozen, so I'm going to go there. So then this one says, well, I'll go in between, and I will play middleman to the two. So the same concrete whole earth is peopled in different ways by different temperaments. And according to the law, Bema sees it looking for it, each one will go, look at the same reality, and select what he organically feels that he needs. And so with the gods, the Norse gods are very vigorous fellows, and they're concerned with a fight with the ice and the terrible, awful forces up here. Their gods are always fighting in a very vigorous way. Now, some other things down here would not fight in the same way, and they'd be more concerned with sensual activities. And in between, there would be this relating factor again. So that each nation, going into a certain environment, having certain experiences, will select from those experiences the aspect that appeals to his own purpose. And his purpose is that which he, from his initial movement, when he mobilized his feeling for the first time, gave him the inertia to travel in a certain direction. And he won't stop dead and go another way. He will always change his direction from where he is without jolting himself too much. So we can say that even though Ham has read the Bible, and the Bible says that Ham must serve Shem and Yafet, nevertheless Ham says, I prefer not to believe it. He doesn't like that part of the Bible, so he ignores it. Or he says, I'm not a Hamite at all, it's some other people. So whatever the facts are, each person will tend by his natural inertias to interpret it in such a way that he can carry on exactly as before.
When you spoke just now about being generally free or particularly free, I take it that was concerned with the clarity of your concept.
Yes.
And that must also have something, must have a very close relation to your feeling condition.
Oh, yes.
Because you can't get the clarity in the thought without your feelings are such that they are a universal feeling.
Well, you have to be very careful about your terms. Universal feeling here means feeling the whole universe. Yes? Suppose when you go to sell a scientist, you go into a small room. Do you want universal feeling there, or the feeling in that particular room, or both?
Well, I think it's as well to have both, actually.
Well, if you don't have the universal feeling as a framework, you won't know precisely what that particular feeling means. And you know that if you get that feeling, that peculiar balance, then you'll know before you start to talk whether you're wasting your time. And if you think it's going to be a waste of time, you won't bother to push it, because time, in such a job, is money, isn't it? So sensitivity of feeling can open a door for you. And it can also make you know that even an open door may have no sale at the end of it. The lady might be just lonely and want you to give you a cup of tea. Whatever it is, this sensitivity of feeling is the key to all these different activities. The scientist in the laboratory mixing something has to be very, very sensitive. Because this sensitivity is not usual in people, they're always devising new and more mechanical methods of eliminating the errors that arise from insensitivity. So they get a young fellow of 20-something and say, weigh those out. And they'll tell him, weigh them out to such and such a number of decimals. Because if they left it to him, he wouldn't do it right, really. So they have to give him a formula to work to. But if you refine your sensitivity, you can be finer than any machine that can be made out of gross material, because you'll have some other forces than the gross material in you, and with these forces you can balance in a much more fine way. So it's always through an increase of feeling sensitivity that intellect grows. Remember, Christ says, as a man thinks in his heart, so is he. Thinking, intellection, and heart, feeling. When you put your idea into your feeling and feel the value of the idea, then the idea will begin to give up secrets that it's got. First of all, it's complex. An idea is a form, and a form has an outside and an inside and a between. And so you'll begin to find, by simple feeling, whether a given idea is wholly unsuitable or partially unsuitable. And by very, very careful feeling, you can find out whether the idea can be separated and part put away and another part retained. And we can say that wherever an idea is separable, the corresponding object of the idea is also separable. So that true manipulations with ideas in correspondence with fact give the power to perform operations in the material world. It's in this sense that the power resides in the knowledge. And yet the knowledge can only grow by increased sensitivity. I heard on the news tonight that the Queen was going to drink a toast to the Shah of Iran. Not to the Shah of Persia, to the Shah of Iran. Why? Because Iran means Aryan, and we also are Aryan. Now, to make such a statement, to reject a word for another word, some people say, what's in a name? And the answer is trouble. If we could persuade them that we are Aryans in the same sense that they are Iranians, we might get an alliance out of them. In any case, Persia means the affirmation of reason, so why call them reasonable? Maybe they'll become reasonable if we tell them, and then where will we be? We specialise in perfidy, which is faith in reason. So if we make them able to be so reasonable, how will we manipulate policy? So better to be Iranians, which means to be running about like snakes. Now, when such a statement is made publicly, it isn't made for nothing. It's a little propaganda thing. And it biases feelings. Oh, it's not Persia, no, it's Iran. They don't know what Persia is and they don't know what Iran is, but they do feel differently about Persians and Iranians. And it's in this feeling that the bias comes. And the whole art of propaganda is to create an emotional bias. Now, feeling is a generic term which includes sensations and emotions. When the feeling originates in a mental state on the inside, it is then central in origin and is called emotion, outmotion. When the feeling originates in the periphery, by sense contact with an object, then it is called sensation. So sensation comes from outside, emotion comes from inside, and both are feelings. For the purpose of physiological fact, the inside of your mouth is outside. The inside of your stomach is outside. You have to consider that wherever the stimulus can come to you from anything other than the mental sphere, it is called external and peripheral, and the result is a sensation. But if the feeling comes from the mind, it is called an emotion. So central stimulation means stimulation within the sphere of the mind itself. You remember we discussed quite a time ago the extant and the nemic stimuli. An extant stimulus strikes on your organism from some surface, and the nemic stimulus is in your memory, and it contains two types of motion. Motion originally from sense stimuli and now stored up in the memory, and motion from your ancestors through your very tissue, through hereditaments, instinctive and so on, which you don't learn from outside. So in the nemic field you can remember two types, namely the ancestral things, which the collective unconscious psychologists are concerned with, the archetypal images, and the memories of your particular experience. And when you look in your own mind, you should train yourself to see the source of a feeling, to be able to say, is this an individual resultant of an experience, or is it an hereditament? And to know whether you have to break it up as an individual, or whether it is an ancestral determinant that should be utilized. And as you become aware of these different determinants of action, and know the exact difference between an emotion and a sensation, then you begin to get control. You can't get control until you become conscious. You can't become conscious unless you refine your feeling. Feeling originally is a word used for the sense of touch. All our psychological terms derive from primarily mechanical concepts, and they have to do with the five senses as illustrations of experiences that we have. Yet once we've had them, they become psychological in value. Feeling, instead of being merely the sense of touch, then becomes that whereby we detect pleasures and pains in their various degrees. If the pleasure is so very, very slight, or the pain is so very slight that we can't detect it, we call it indifference. And if we are indifferent, we never move. So that movement, mobilization of the feeling, depends upon the presence of a pleasant or painful stimulus. And the stimulus can either be a sensation or an emotion. If it's a sensation, there is an immediate pressure on the body from something. And if painful, we will do our best to get rid of the offending object. But if the thing comes from inside the mind, the only way we can get rid of an unpleasant idea is to repress it or to transcend it. If we repress it, we just bury it in the mind and it still works in us to our detriment. If we transcend it and look at it from above and just say that is an unpleasant mental content and leave it at that and don't orientate towards it, then gradually the energy with which it was packed drains away and you become released from it. But every extant situation has an element of pleasure or pain in it, and every nemic situation derived from an extant situation has pleasure and pain in it, and therefore your memory is surcharged with little impulses of pleasure and pain. And it is these pleasures and pains that cause association of ideas in the body. So that unless you can break the pleasure-pain dominion in your own memory, you cannot become free. A man believes because it is pleasant to believe. The word belief itself is from a word, same as the German Leben, love, to hold dear, to have deep regard for. Belief is that which you hold because you like it. So that involved in belief is pleasure and pain. And if you don't sort out why you are liking one thing rather than another, namely because it has been pleasant or painful to you, then you must necessarily be subject to it internally. So from the point of view of practice, you should cut into your own mental processes whenever you can. Practice should be continuous. And whenever you feel a liking or a disliking, say immediately, and this arises out of an extant or a nemic situation. And if nemic, it's either individual nemic or hereditament, racial nemic. And you decide which it is, and in that moment of decision, you suddenly release yourself from it as a determinant of your action. Good night.
What about a rude word that makes you feel angry? It's come in as a sensation, hasn't it?
What do you mean a rude word? Do you mean a rudimentary word? Tram root? Try literal root? Or do you mean a word with associations that suggests that you're an inferior being? Well, that's entirely conditioned reflex, isn't it? For instance, practically all the really rude words in English are simple Saxon words. They're simply the only word that a Saxon had for that kind of activity. They were rudimentary words. So if you're insulted by them, it means that you had your reflexes conditioned. The best cure for it is suddenly to say to yourself, this is Saxon. I've learned a Saxon word today. You're continuously reinterpreting what the fellow is saying. He's your opponent. It's like playing chess, you see. Grabbers would have told us the other day that playing chess is very good if you can't play. And it's the same thing with this game. Somebody insults you and you don't understand the word. That's the most important thing. To tell yourself, I don't understand this word, really. I've been responding to it at the level of a conditioned reflex. But what does it really mean? And then say to the fellow, I don't really understand that word at all. And mean it. That's the important thing. Mean it. Say, can you help me? Do you know what it means? You know what happened to him, don't you, unless he didn't train you. You'll have to find another word, won't you? The whole thing is converting energy. Remember a stimulus that hits you on one of your five senses, and a rude word is a stimulus hitting you in the ear. It's energy. If you can keep it in, it's yours. Do you want such rude energies? The answer is yes, they're rudimentary. They're primitive forces. If you can get the single syllable rudery out of some expressions and hold it in, you've got an ooh word, haven't you? A primary urge, that's power. All right, get hold of it. Keep it. Thank you very much. And you have another one. And to do this quite sincerely and deliberately determine that you will get down to the bottom of it. Don't be a system of conditioned reflexes. Because if you are, it means that anybody can just study you a bit, find out your reaction points, and then run you all over the place. Which is dreadful. To know that you could be studied like an animal, all your taxisms noted by some smarty, and he could then jab you with terms, and you'd tear your hair out. That's dreadful. It's subhuman. The thing is to release yourself from all conditioned reflexes. And you can do so by simply demanding to know the real meaning every time. Break through it, say this is a reflex. I've been conditioned. You know, in America the swear words are not the same as they are here, are they? Some words are quite rude there that don't bother us. So, it is entirely contextual. You say a Saxon rude letter word to a Japanese and he doesn't know what you mean. But he says something else. And therefore you can see in the fact that these stimuli are all contextual, that they are really conditioned reflexes. And the man who responds is no better than one of Pavlov's dogs responding to the bell, which isn't a nice concept.
Well, if you do manage to turn around, you actually
inducted everything. Oh yes, and it's yours. The important thing then is when you've gained that bit of energy to watch that you don't run off home and tell somebody about it. You see, the tendency is when you've gained a bit of energy because you're not used to it, you think, well, I must tell somebody about it. I'm burst. People say that, don't they? I must tell somebody about it. I'm burst. Because when energy is brought in, if it isn't made to rotate, it'll go out. And if you manage to shut up for 2 minutes because the fellow is bigger than you, as soon as he goes away and a smaller one comes, you'll tell it to him.
So you also have to have the ability to control the
fellow. Well, that's continence, containingness. Containingness is a supreme virtue. Virtue means power. That's all it means, power. And continence is a supreme virtue. If you can contain power, and well, certainly, tautologically, it's power you can be contained. So the continent man is the most virtuous man. So the man that can actually keep a really fundamental secret to himself, he's doing very nicely, and he's very virtuous, whatever the church says. And the point is, you will never tell the secret that you're working on, but only the one you're transcending. The one you're working on, you want to keep that energy, because you want to transcend that level. That keeps the hierarchy in being. It says, it is the glory of God to conceal a thing. It's another way of making the statement. God remains infinite, because if he finites himself, people recognize him straight away.
I mean, when you give something out, you're negating it, really.
Oh, yeah. You're giving it finite expression. When you're giving it out,
yes.
If you finish with it, it doesn't matter to you whether it goes down to the bottom if you finish with it.
If you hit your thumb with a hammer, is that power that's come in? Because you're let fly with a word then, and you might let it out again.
If you hit your thumb with a hammer?
Your thumb.
Oh, your thumb, your own thumb. Oh yes, definitely.
That's a stimulus, isn't it? That
yes.
It's come in from outside, and it's a painful one.
Well, did you hit it?
Well,
if you did, you've lost as much as you gained. You're just about the same, aren't you?
Well,
it was very urgeful of you to hit it. So you've lost a certain amount of urge, and in hitting it, you now gained a certain amount of intellectual power. Don't do it again.
But if you swear about that, if you let the energy out...
Ah, that's a great shame. That's a devil lot. It's very, very common for a person who wants to hit another person to hit himself. And the more decent concept he has of himself, the more likely he is to injure himself rather than another person. When he's feeling particularly vengeful. A lot of accidents are caused by that. Terrible feelings of aggression against people and situations produce an accident on the person with the aggressive feeling.